The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
This is Still Processing. Mr. Wesley Morris.
Miss Jenna Wortham.
I know we already talked about Green Book.
We sure did.
But the Oscars are this Sunday, and this movie might win Best Picture.
Oh, Lord, no. Roma, please let Roma win.
I think we have to talk about it, because there's one scene that I cannot get out of my mind.
Okay, which one?
So it's the scene where Tony Vallelonga, who is the Italian-American guy from the Bronx, who's been hired to drive Don Shirley, this black musician, to his gigs. Okay, so it's the scene where Tony saves Don from a bunch of unruly racists at a bar.
I mean, I can imagine what bothered you about that, but why did it bother you?
The scene is meant to teach the audience that the guys that are beating up Don are the real racists, and Tony is kind of like a milquetoast racist. He's, like, not that bad of a racist. He's only ever called Don a couple of names behind his back and kind of to his face. And the whole movie up until this point has given you the impression that Tony doesn't like black people. But the moment the movie takes you into the scene in the bar, you understand, actually, these are the real racists because they're capable of physical violence against someone just because they're black. And Tony, he's not really a bad guy after all. He just needs like a little bit of kneading. He needs a little bit of coaxing. But you know what? He's actually on the right side of things, and you can bring him back over to the right side, to the good side of history. And it's infuriating. It's infuriating, Wesley, the idea that racism is only bad if it escalates into physical violence, and that the tiny little microaggressions, the things that dehumanize and demoralize and stereotype aren't actually really bad types of racism after all. So maybe they get a pass.
Right.
It feels like a very sanitized scene about racial dynamics that's designed specifically to make audiences feel better about themselves.
And it's amazing that you're bringing this up on the weekend of the Academy Awards.
Yes.
The same Academy Awards in which Green Book is nominated for 5 Oscars and is likely to win 2 or 3, including Best Picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's in company with movies like A Star is Born and The Favorite and Vice about Dick Cheney. And, of course, Black Klansman and Black Panther.
Right. Oh, boy.
If Green Book does win, it'll be in really good company with the Best Picture winners of the last 30 years. Specifically when it comes to films about race, right? I just think America is obsessed with this sort of racial healing fantasy where there is a work that, like, being near a black person can do to rehabilitate prejudiced people. And all that rubbing up against, yelling at, friction, tension, touching, hugging, driving will bring him to the light.
Right. It's its own trope, yeah.
Right.
Well, what other films in the past have done this? What are you thinking about?
I don't know. I mean, if we're just staying in the 30-year window, something like Forrest Gump. Came out in 94, won Best Picture in 95. The story of a very simple man named Forrest Gump.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates.
Sits on a bench and starts just talking to anybody who sits down next to him about his life.
You never know what you're going to get.
He winds up befriending this other guy named Bubba.
Good old Bubba.
On a good day, you can catch over 100 pounds of shrimp. Shrimp is the fruit of the sea. You can barbecue it, boil it, broil it, bake it, saute it.
They both have the same IQ. Uh-huh. But the point is that Forrest is the person on the journey, and a person like Bubba is another step along the way. So one of which puts him on campus when George Wallace is denouncing the integration of the University of Alabama.
Right.
And part of that sequence when Vivian Malone, who's one of the new black students, drops her notebook on the way inside to school, the visual effects people make it so that Forrest picks up the notebook and hands it to Vivian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just weird to me, like, you realize in a moment like that, like, the movie's about Forrest, not Vivian, who I would say has a much more interesting American story to tell about what this country is all about.
I agree.
And it isn't that Forrest gets made a better person because of black people, but it is that Forrest gets to look askance or not even see a lot of the problems in this country, all of which is shouldered by Jenny, who's played by Robin Wright, who is near some Black Panthers who do nothing when she's beaten up by her white, peace-loving boyfriend. The racial politics of this movie are crazy anyway. All the politics in this movie, to be fair, are crazy. But they all sort of benefit Forrest Gump. The fantasy here, of course, is that if you're good enough and simple enough, America's racial problems can be healed. Give this movie a Best Picture Oscar.
Okay. I mean, what else?
Crash. Best Picture winner of 2006.
Oh, Lord.
A movie so frightening that Jenna Wortham refuses to watch it.
Facts. Facts only.
Basically, it's one of these race and racism are driving everybody in Los Angeles out of their minds. The Persians, the Mexicans, the white people, the black people. But the thing that really takes me out is you have all of these different people of different races all being nasty to each other because of race. But guess who the redeemed characters are in this movie?
Oh, my God. I don't even want to know.
Sandra Bullock.
Of course.
Like, the second biggest racist in the movie. She gets carjacked by Ludacris and Lorenz Tate.
Maybe I will watch this.
You've had a really tough night. I think it'd be best if you just went upstairs right
and
now.
And what, wait for them to break in? I just had a gun pointed in my face.
You lower your voice.
And it was my fault because I knew it was going to happen. But if a white person sees two black men walking towards her and she turns and walks in the other direction, she's a racist, right? Well, I got scared and I didn't say anything. And 10 seconds later, I had a gun in my face. Now, I am telling you, your amigo in there is going to sell our key to one of his homies. And this time it'd be really fucking great if you acted like you actually gave a shit.
And then what happens? She falls down the steps on a lot of painkillers or something and decides that her Mexican maid, Maria, is her new best friend. I assume Maria wants to go home, but you know, we don't know because the movie's not about Maria. It's about Sandra Bullock. But the real star of that movie is Matt Dillon, racist cop Matt Dillon, feels up Tandy Newton at a traffic stop, doesn't like black people, but would certainly put his hands all over a black woman.
Ugh.
So she gets into a horrible car crash. The car is on fire. Guess who comes in to save the day?
Ma'am, you hear me? Her mics are rolling. He'll be here in 2 minutes. All right, get an extinguisher and get that fire out. Jesus.
Best Supporting Actor nomination for that gentleman.
Okay, I'm going to get you out.
Matt Dillon, who proves he's not a racist because he's capable of saving some black person's life even after he's violated it. And then Driving Miss Daisy, the epitome of this sort of problem. And it wins Best Picture in 1990, came out in 89. Huge hit.
Yeah.
Better movie than you think, actually, because I think it understands the thing that you and I are talking about, right? That there is something inherently impossible about black people and white people being friends, at least according to the way the country is set up, to like have both those friends be equal in the friendship. So it is a story of this old Jewish woman named Daisy Wortham. Sorry, this old Jewish woman named Daisy Worthen.
Are we related?
I hope not.
Oh, God.
Her son, Bully, hires Hoke, Morgan Freeman, to drive her.
Piggly Wiggly. And home. Nowhere else.
Yeah. Oh, I just love the smell of a new car. Don't you, Miss Daisy?
So they have this relationship, and at some point, Daisy comes down with, after many years of their working together, she comes down with dementia.
Oh, okay.
And during one of her episodes, the first episode we ever see her have, she takes Hoke's hand and she says,
Hoke?
Yes.
You're my best friend.
No, go on now, Miss Daisy.
No, really. You are.
Oh, Jessica Tandy.
Best actress winner.
Of course.
Jessica Tandy. Best Picture winners are usually about white people, and anytime a movie about race that involves black people wins, it's probably been on the white person's terms. It's almost 100% been on the white person's terms. This is throughout the history of the Academy Awards. And It's crazy to me that that movie won Best Picture in 1990 because there was another movie that was trying to tell us the way it actually was about race in this country.
Right.
We'll take a break and then we'll get into it when we get back.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in Southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
At the 1990 Academy Awards, your five Best Picture nominees were Driving Miss Daisy, Myla Foote, Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, and Field of Dreams. And they bring a bunch of people out to introduce the Best Picture nominees, show some clips.
Thank you, and hello, the world.
So then Kim Basinger comes out, who, by the way, is at the height of her fame. She's Vicki Vale in Tim Burton's Batman movie. She's having a little affair with Prince. She's supposed to present one of the nominees for Best Picture.
We've got five great films here, and they're great for one reason. Because they tell the truth.
And then things kind of take a turn.
But there is one film missing from this list that deserves to be on it because, ironically, it might tell the biggest truth of all. And that's Do the Right Thing.
So out of nowhere, Kim Basinger goes out on a limb for this movie and for Spike Lee, who she hadn't even met. This is totally unexpected. Nobody in the audience knows what to do.
I mean, props to her for using her platform in a way that she felt inclined to, but she really decided to spend all her social capital coins on Mr. Spike Lee.
You know, she does go back on script and introduce Dead Poets Society.
Okay.
But, you know, the Academy's mad, and they banned her until they unbanned her by giving her an Oscar.
Oh, my God.
9 years later for L.A. Confidential.
Fascinating.
But the thing was, she was speaking this sentiment that was widely felt at the time, which basically was that Do the Right Thing stands out for speaking this truth that no other movie is going to speak. Nobody else is going to be as honest as that movie was.
Not then, not now. Who knows if ever.
Even in 2019, when Spike Lee is up for three Oscars for BlacKkKlansman, directing, writing, and producing BlacKkKlansman, we still don't have a film as truthful when it comes to race in America as Do the Right Thing. So it makes me want to revisit what was so good and revolutionary about what he did in 89, because for as much as the very end of BlacKkKlansman is amazingly topical about things that have been going on in this country for the last 3 years, Do the Right Thing feels to me like it was meant to last forever and is commenting on the last 300 years. And, I mean, it's the best picture for any year. Do the Right Thing is set on one block in Bedford-Stuyvesant, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, on the hottest day of the year in 1989. The central site of the movie is Sal's Famous Pizzeria. And basically, you're watching more than a dozen and a half characters of many races try to figure out how not to kill each other. So of these 15 characters, you've got Mookie, who delivers the pizzas at Sal's. He is played by Spike Lee. He's of the neighborhood, but also works for what becomes the neighborhood scourge in Sal's. You've got Radio Raheem, big guy with a boombox and a flat top who walks around the movie playing the movie's theme song, Fight the Power. You've got Buggin' Out, the neighborhood hothead activist. And then you've got somebody like Pino and Vito, who are Sal's sons. Pino is a racist, and Vito just wants to be friends with Mookie. So then all these characters culminate on Sal's in this explosive moment. All Buggin' Out and Radio Raheem say they want us a slice, even though Sal's is closed. They come in with the boombox. Sal goes nuts. Radio Raheem tries to choke Sal. The police show up, and they wind up killing Radio Raheem. And then after Radio Raheem dies, all hell breaks loose. Now, it's important to just say really quickly, it came out in the summer of 1989, and Spike Lee wrote and directed it. It's his third movie after She's Gotta Have It and School Days.
Oh, okay.
And it came out during a period in which the country, and New York City in particular, had been roiled by so many unjust deaths of Black people, either by racists or by a racist NYPD system. And the movie is dedicated to two women and four men who were either killed by white racists or by the police. And I'm talking about incidents like in 1984 when a woman named Eleanor Bumpers was shot and killed during an altercation with the police. She was elderly and disabled and basically guilty of holding a knife. Or the case of Michael Griffith in 1986, this 23-year-old guy whose car breaks down. He was trying to find someone to help him fix it, and he was basically set upon and chased by a bunch of white guys in the neighborhood of Howard Beach in New York, and he was trying to flee them, winds up running onto a highway and is hit by a car, and that person, that driver, keeps going. And the movie comes out the same year as the incident involving the Central Park jogger and five of the young Black and Latino men who were accused of having assaulted and raped her. So there was a sense that this movie was going to come out and ignite a lot of racial hatred and passion. And then what do we do?
Now, to be clear, this was much bigger than New York. The entire nation was in crisis. Black unemployment was almost three times higher than white unemployment. And the introduction of trickle-down economics further disadvantaged Black families and kept them economically depressed and unable to raise their status. So whatever was supposed to be trickling down didn't get that far. And you had all these media reports that were encouraging widespread anxiety around Black-on-white crime in big cities. TLDR, it was a bad time in this country if you were a Black person. Now, you could say it's a bad time anytime to be a Black person in this country, but things at that particular moment were dire. And so you have this film come out that beautifully visually articulates some of these problems in one neighborhood in New York, Black Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy.
And the genius of this movie is that it's set on one day.
Is it really only one day?
One day.
Wow.
On one block.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the intersection of Stuyvesant Avenue and Quincy Street.
Mm.
And you're looking at a cast of characters trying to, like, live a normal Saturday.
Yeah.
Until all hell breaks loose.
Right. All hell breaks loose because it's the hottest day of the year, and the temperature is high in more ways than one. There's this white-owned pizzeria in the middle of this Black neighborhood that's just become an epicenter in many ways because it's a place where everybody hangs out. It's a place where people go for their dollar slice. It's also a place that, while the majority of its patrons are Black people, Black residents of this neighborhood, it's a restaurant that doesn't seem to really like Black culture or Black people.
Yo, Mook!
Okay.
Mookie! So you know I'm still...
What?
How come you got no brothers up on the wall?
Well, specifically, there's this wall that Sal's famous pizzeria has loaded with great Italian-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
And one character in the neighborhood, his name is Buggin' Out, comes in and wants to know, hey, why are there no Black people on the wall?
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is Black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
He's about to eat a slice and once again, presumably for like the 100th time, is reminded when he looks up to bite into his pizza that there's like Frank Sinatra staring down at him. And he's like, what is going on with this? I don't like it. So he spends his movie trying to wage a boycott against Sal's to like get Sal either to put some black people on the wall or get out of our neighborhood. And you, over the course of these 2 hours, meet about a dozen and a half other characters who have a stake in the everyday life of this neighborhood and it remaining a relatively safe place to live. And it takes what might seem cute about any one of these people and brings out this ugliness that they all have.
Dago wop, guinea, garlic bread, pizza slinging, spaghetti bending, Vic Damone, Perry Como, Luciano Pavarotti.
Whether it's Mookie himself stereotyping Italian Americans,
gold chain wearing fried chicken and biscuit eating monkey, eight baboon, big thigh, fast running, high jumping, spear chucking, 360 degree basketball dunking, titsoon spade, Moulinard.
Or Pino, Sal's son, saying derogatory things about Mookie.
It's cheap. I got good price for you, mere cacci. How I'm doing? Chocolate, egg cream drinking, bagel and deluxe.
Or the seemingly nice Korean bodega owner who has these anti-Semitic views. It just takes each one of the ethnicities in this neighborhood and in this panoramic view of New York and all these characters and brings out something nasty in each of them. And that seems revolutionary to me because it totally humanizes them in an unflattering and, I would say, unprecedentedly honest way.
And at the time, race in America was largely treated as a black and white issue. So it's particularly remarkable to see the inclusion of the Korean family, for instance, as a way to talk about the intersection and cultural clashes between black and Asian communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is happening a couple of years before the murder of Latasha Harlins, the 15-year-old black girl who's shot and killed by a Korean shopkeeper in Los Angeles that gets national attention and is considered to be one of the events that precipitated the protests and demonstrations in South Los Angeles.
Right.
What moves me about that scene in particular is it kind of doesn't let you get away with racism, even if we think, okay, everybody's a little bit racist. Shout out to Avenue Q. It doesn't make it pretty. It doesn't make it okay.
Right,
it's still incredibly ugly, no matter who it's coming from. And I think I like that it doesn't let even the marginalized people get off the hook.
Right.
The film is asking really big and unwieldy questions about gentrification, how we build community, questions of respectability, and the problems of integration. And they're really, really frank discussions.
You almost knocked me down, man. The word is excuse me.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
One of the best parts in the film for me that I laughed out loud several times is there's a group of kids, neighborhood kids, hanging out, and into the scene comes a white guy walking with his bike, wearing a Larry Bird jersey, which is important because
Larry Bird is the most famous white guy in the NBA and the white sports media's savior, basically.
Who told you to step on my sneakers? Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block, in my neighborhood, on my side of the street? Yo, what you want to live in a black neighborhood for anyway, man?
He scuffs Buggin' Out's Jordans.
Right, and everybody loses their mind.
You're lucky the black man has a loving heart. Next time you see me coming, then you cross the street quick.
I'm out of here.
Yo, man, break his feet. Come on,
bars. Take his gun. I should make you buy me another pair.
And it's just like this great moment where you see the, like, the entitlement and, like, disregard of a white person who wants to be in this neighborhood and the way it makes these kids feel displaced and disregarded. And it's a brief scene, but it's very well done.
I think that that scene is also interesting to me because there really isn't anything Buggin' Out can do except run his mouth.
But it gets at this underlying tension that the film is about in general, which is, what do you do when you have no options? Like, what do you do when you don't have any actual power? You don't have generational wealth behind you. You don't have probably a ton of employment options. It's like the way in which this country has historically disenfranchised black people via the scene with these kids. They're powerless. So all they can do is make this guy uncomfortable. It's just the vicious cycle that everybody's a part of.
Exactly.
So even though this movie came out 30 years ago, it's still doing more to further the discussion about racism in this country more than any of the other nominees do this year.
Let's talk about how exactly in a second. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
The movie comes out July 4th weekend.
Hold the phone. Hold the phone, sir. What?
Probably should have said this earlier, but yeah. Comes out July 4th weekend.
Oh, that's bold.
1989.
That's bold.
There wasn't a single cause of the chaos, but an aggressive police department and the soundtrack of the summer. Public enemies fight the power played a role when the violence broke out as police attempted to clear the streets. Virginia Beach Police Chief Jim Cervera was a sergeant in the police department.
Public Enemy, with their song Fight the Power, which when we were on Atlantic Avenue and the kids were chanting Fight the Power, it went into Fight the Police.
Here is what Joe Klein, future author of Primary Colors, wrote in New York Magazine about Do the Right Thing.
Okay.
If Lee does hook large black audiences, there's a good chance the message they take from the film will increase racial tensions in the city.
The fear-mongering, wow.
If they react violently, which can't be ruled out.
Jeez.
The New York City mayoral candidate with the most to lose will be David Dinkins. Anybody doesn't remember David Dinkins, he became the future black mayor of New York City. The only black mayor of New York City.
Wow.
So Joe Klein was basically saying, hey, Spike Lee, if Dinkins loses, it's on you.
Wow.
Because these black people are going to go crazy seeing this. They're going to think it's a license to riot.
It's true that the end of that movie leaves you with so much rage. It's kind of like when you read Roots for the first time. It's just devastating. But the implication, though, that somehow black people are going to be more prone to violence than anyone that saw a movie like Terminator is ridiculous.
Can I also just say, the people who are mad about this movie, the people who are most mad in public about this movie, mostly white people.
Right, right.
They were the angriest about this movie.
Because they got put on blast. And I guess that's why Kim Basinger upset the world and upset the Academy so much, because she was puncturing the bubble that Hollywood was living in, that the world was living in, that things were okay and that things were on the upswing and that there was a lot more to feel good about than feel bad about. And Kim Basinger was essentially an anti-gravity button bringing everybody back to reality.
Yeah, and it's important to note one thing about the ceremony that night. I think that might have been the most black people ever nominated for Oscars in one night at that point. You had Spike Lee nominated for his screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
You had Morgan Freeman nominated for Driving Miss Daisy. And you had Denzel Washington nominated for Glory. Denzel won.
Dang.
And so that's a big deal.
Wesley, I want to hear you talk about for a minute, like, why the film was so incendiary. Why was it so threatening to Hollywood?
Because it didn't give them any easy options.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and this is going to sound crazy, but I think another thing was that we were really in love with the Huxtables.
Mm.
We were really in love with that depiction of black people in popular culture.
So what you're saying is there were no magical Negroes in Do the Right Thing, just a whole lot of contentious black people.
Yes. And most of them had a legitimate grievance.
Yeah.
And so you factor that idea that at that moment, the country was thinking they were understanding black people through this one fictional family while ignoring the entire rest of everything terrible that was happening to black people in major cities around the country. And then You want to pretend that this thing that we called race relations in the 1990s was good.
That's right.
And that, you know, if you're a white person and you've got a little bit of racism in you, you're one feel-good friendship away from improving yourself.
Yeah, that the antidote to the problems in this country aren't policies that enable the disenfranchised people in this country to get a leg up or to get a stronger footing in society. It's actually befriend a black person. You'll be much better for it.
Yeah, and this movie gives you so many reminders that things aren't great. The NYPD kills Radio Raheem by choking him to death.
And then try to hide it by stuffing him in the back of the car.
Yes, the police cruiser that becomes a hearse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, the high point of the controversy is when Mookie, after Radio Raheem's been killed, after it seems like the neighborhood is really beginning to turn on Sal and his two sons and Mookie, who both physically and occupationally is aligned Sal and his sons.
Right.
He works for Sal. But I mean, the way Spike Lee has choreographed the sequence, he is standing in alignment, like alongside these other three guys. And so the neighborhood is starting to turn on all four of them. And at some point during this protest against them, Mookie, who's played by Spike Lee, goes and gets a trash can and throws it through the window of Sal's famous pizzeria. And a riot ensues in which everybody outside the pizzeria comes in and basically loots, destroys, demolishes this symbol of so much that is wrong with the neighborhood, the city, the country.
You can't help but get the feeling that the people who are the most angry about this film seem to feel like Spike Lee's obligation as a filmmaker was to give them and us hope, right? Like, the only purpose of visual culture and the movies is to make us feel good and lie to us a little bit, basically to be a virtual Xanax, more or less. And Spike Lee won't do it. He won't do it. He will not give people what they felt entitled to in the form of this film.
Yeah.
And even the title is interesting. Like, what was the right thing?
Well, I mean, in this case, what was the right thing that nobody in this movie actually does? You know, you have like 15, 16 people.
Yeah.
Each one of whom does something that I can identify as being a problem, both in the world, in the real world.
Yes.
And in this sort of fantasy land that the movies create about how people are supposed to act and still be protagonists.
Right.
Even within people, there are contradictions. You have a character like Mother Sister, who is essentially a good neighborhood window lady, right? She spends the whole movie looking out her window, kind of making fun of Demare, her love interest, basically.
Right.
But then when Sal's goes up in flames, she's one of the people standing in the street screaming, burn it down, burn it down. Every single one of the characters in this movie, whether they're minor characters or, you know, more significant ones, has this internal contradiction that gives this movie this rich ambivalence about everything.
And I think until that moment in time, filmmakers who reached the kind of prominence that Spike Lee had with Do the Right Thing and filmmakers who made a film as landmark and as culturally relevant as Spike Lee did typically were appealing for a type of humanity with their black characters that Spike Lee just refused to do. Like, his goal was not to get white people to feel empathy for the black people. His goal was to validate and affirm the experience of himself and black people watching the movie, which is not something I would imagine like white judges wanted to reward him for and encourage.
This movie, we find out once we get to the closing credits, it's been dedicated to six people who'd been either killed by racists or killed by the NYPD. Mm. And not all of the people who died those deaths were squeaky clean individual people, right?
It never works that way.
And the thing
There's
about,
no way to be a perfect victim.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And none of the people in this movie are perfect victims.
Right, right.
None of the people in this movie deserve what they get, but they're also not people that you might want to have anything to do with.
Which is actually a much more humane approach as a filmmaker, because it actually does create a kind of empathy for the fact that, yeah, victims aren't perfect people. Now that we're talking about this, I'm thinking that Do the Right Thing is not, it's not a directive for anyone in the film. It's a directive for the culture at large.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's good.
Do the right thing.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, you need to do the right thing.
Yeah, it's not my job.
It's not my job,
I'm
actually
just presenting a problem. Don't blame me if people get upset. People are already upset. I'm just capturing what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that's sort of, when it comes to the Oscars, is that we get trained to expect these clean, tidy movies.
Mm.
And It feels good to celebrate a movie like Driving Miss Daisy because it's tidy.
Yeah, of course.
But we feel, conversely, so entitled to not have to deal with, to Forrest Gump our way through life. When confronted with some actual hard-to-take stuff, you know, most of us are Jennies in this world. Do you know what I mean? Like, most of us can't be Forrest.
Oh.
And so the idea that, like, you're watching something like Green Book and the appeal of that movie is certainly going to be the redemptive impulse. The idea that you can take this bad person who does these horrible things and turn him into a saint.
Right.
I don't know. It's just strange that we have this redemption narrative happening at the same time that people like Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, who got caught either being in a Klan hood or in deep blackface.
And we don't know which. We don't know which it is. Nope. We don't know which it is.
Don't know which. And then Mark Herring, who's the lieutenant governor, who, prompted by maybe the possibility that we would find out for ourselves that he's got some blackface in his past.
It's crazy.
Comes forward. Or like Liam Neeson.
Oh my God.
Where he confesses that he really was one of these taken characters.
Jeez.
And hunted down black people because a friend of his said to him that she'd been raped by a black person.
But he's sorry now, so he just wants you to know. He's not really a racist, but he once had a really bad racist thought.
So you have all these people coming forward and confessing all these things about
right.
the racism in their past and expecting that in those confessions, there is a way that we as a nation can heal or that we're supposed to believe that bad people who or people who do stupid or bad or ignorant or racist things can't learn from their mistakes or their bad behavior. Of course they can. But the thing that sort of drives me crazy is that a lot of that redemption comes at the expense of black people.
Yeah.
It comes at the expense of black people being made inhuman first.
Mm.
And that your confession doesn't restore humanity.
Right.
It's the Matt Dillon and Crash problem. Like, yes, we now know that you, racist cop, are capable of doing something good, but it does nothing to atone for or account for.
Speak on it.
The trauma that you've caused other people.
That's right.
That's the thing that is driving me crazy about everything that's happening right now. Which
yes.
is that these people might get off the hook. These people might get to stay in office, but the objects of their bad behavior, who knows?
Yeah.
Who can say?
Yeah. And the worst part is the culture will probably exonerate them and not ever deal with the conditions that made it socially acceptable for people who eventually ran and won for office to show up at a party in blackface. That never gets dealt with. It's just in the past and we're supposed to move on.
I mean, we're talking about Spike Lee. This is a person who did make a movie about this very subject, by the way.
I know.
It's called Bamboozled.
I know.
And it's all about putting a TV show on the air with black people in blackface is supposed to be a bomb, but guess what? It's a huge hit.
You could not script this moment if you took a ton of mushrooms and tried.
You're right, Jenna.
What you're saying, Wesley, is true. Like, he told us as a culture we would end up here way more than Green Book could ever do.
We're living in a Spike Lee movie. But people don't want that answer.
Oof.
And it sounds to me like what you're actually asking are, like, really, like, fundamentally moral questions about our entertainment.
Yes. Watching a film like Green Book left me with a deep depression and deep sadness because I don't understand what's the point of popular culture, what's the point of art, if you want to call that film art, if it's not going to reflect or deal with the world that we live in. And if it's not going to deal with the actual reality of the world, then how do we get to the point where we have a shared understanding of what the world is that we're living in? What I'm coming back to is this broader question of what happens when the culture that we consume is anesthetizing rather than catalyzing or awakening or helping us deal with hard realities.
I mean, it's not like we're asking every Marvel movie to tackle race. All I'm saying is, when a film is trying to address race, or says it's trying to anyway, I would just like to see it be real about what racism and racial tension in this country actually looks like. Just like Spike Lee did in Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, and you and I aren't trying to prematurely memorialize Spike Lee or even absolve him of his problematic ways, which are plentiful when it comes to women. But we're just trying to acknowledge that he was starting a dialogue with Do the Right Thing that we're eager to keep continuing. And it's frustrating to watch all these films get all these awards that
try to shut it down.
That try to shut it down. That try to act like that dialogue is no longer necessary when you and I both know it is extremely important and still very needed.
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy solution to any of this country's racial trauma. And going on a magical road trip solves nothing when it comes to everything that went on during the civil rights movement, everything yes. that went on during the 70s, everything that led up in the 19th century to having the blackface we are currently dealing with today.
Exactly.
You can't drive away from that problem.
You sure can't. I mean, given all that, Wesley, the Oscars are coming up. What do you think's going to happen? Someone going to throw a trash can through the proverbial Academy window?
Oh, Kim Basinger, where are you? Where are you, Kim?
Come back.
I actually don't know what's going to happen on Sunday. I really don't. But if Spike Lee does win the Oscar over Alfonso Cuarón for Roma, he deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not for BlacKkKlansman, which is not my favorite Spike Lee movie, but definitely for being the bravest and most honest American director of the last 30 years.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Nina Patak.
Our editors are Sasha Weiss and Larissa Anderson.
We get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our engineer is Jake Gorski.
And our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
And remember, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Do you think South Pizza was good?
No. 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 It just looked like bad movie pizza. Which is the real crime.
Nobody talks about that.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.